Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From our cavernous legislative studios on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It's Friday, June 28th, 2019. A happy birthday to Junior Johnson, the legendary moonshiner turned stock car driver, is 88 years young today. No white liquor on this edition of the pod. Today, an analysis of two rulings that came down from the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as some discussion about the state budget. Your guests are Becky Gray and Rob Schofield, respectively, from the conservative John Locke Foundation and the progressive NC Policy Watch. We have kind of a tandem of programs that run on late in the week on WUNC. One is this radio conversation between Becky and Rob. You can always catch it at 4:50 on Fridays during All Things Considered. We also have the WUNC Politics Podcast, which you're listening to now, and sometimes we overlap those two. So topics of discussion on this week's forum between Becky and Rob were the state budget. Full disclosure, we recorded our conversation on a Thursday. So at that point, the governor had yet to veto the budget. We were anticipating it. He has since vetoed the state spending plan. And now we're at the beginning of this impasse. Unclear how long it's going to be before an override takes place or a budget compromise. But we're in the early part of what could be a protracted stalemate. So here, Becky and Rob on the WUNC Politics Podcast. A majority of U.S. Supreme Court justices ruled Thursday that federal courts do not have the authority to stop extreme partisan gerrymandering. The decision was a victory for Republicans here in the state and a blow to critics nationwide who have been trying to curtail the centuries-long practice of partisan boundaries, which has been getting worse in recent years. Chief Justice John Roberts conceded that extreme districting is a problem, but said the job to fix it lies with Congress and at statehouses. While this settles partisan gerrymandering challenges in federal court for at least the next decade, there is another looming legal challenge in state court. In the wake of the federal ruling, a powerful statehouse Republican, David Lewis, called on plaintiffs to end that suit and work with lawmakers on a better process. Is it more likely that significant change would come through the state legal challenge or possibly through some sort of action by lawmakers here?
Well, it's possible, but I mean, I thought it was ironic and interesting that, oh, wow, now Representative Lewis wants to work on this. I mean, he could have been working on redistricting reform for years and years, and now that there's a very strong case working its way through the state courts and that many people expect that there could be a strong decision striking down partisan gerrymandering in North Carolina, he now wants to talk about, you know, cutting another deal. I mean, I'm hopeful still that we could have some sort of redistricting reform passed. If we're going to do it, though, let's do it right. Let's not have some watered-down version of it. Let's not have some version that just swaps out some new secret behind-the-scenes drawing of maps. Let's make it a true open process in which the public can participate and we really know what's going on, a real transparent process. That would be my hope.
This was a really strong decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. And of course, we anxiously awaited this for months and weeks. And as their session wound down, we were expecting it all week. I think it really changes the dynamics and changes the conversation in North Carolina, whether the plaintiffs in the state lawsuit or are successful if they intend to continue the suit. I mean, I don't know. It changes it. You know, to Rob's point about, you know, would there be an independent commission? What's the appetite for that now? This decision makes that seem quite unlikely that they would pursue that. The other thing that we know now, too, is, as I understand it, and again, we're still reading through this decision and trying to understand all the aspects of it, but this would not necessitate the congressional districts be redrawn for 2020. So again, with I'm just kind of hearing out there that there were some folks considering maybe jumping into a congressional race, waiting for this, what those lines might look like, and those kind of things. This offers some certainty with that. And with filing beginning in December, I think it changes the dynamics and certainly changes the conversation around this.
You mentioned it was a strong ruling. You are a conservative, but you're also a supporter of independent redistricting. Was it too strong for your taste?
Well, you know, when you look at it, I don't know. It seems to me that the decision could either go one way or the other. You know, there wasn't a lot of middle ground with this. And one thing that a lot of us have complained about over the years is one of the reasons why there's so much ambiguity and uncertainty and questions around redistricting is because the courts have not taken a strong enough position and have left so many of these questions unanswered. A lot of wiggle room of where you can go that has led to all of these lawsuits. So I think that, you know, if nothing else, we now have a definitive answer from the Supreme Court on this particular kind of gerrymandering. And I think that's positive just in getting the rules straight so that we all understand what we're playing with.
In terms of federal jurisdiction.
Yeah, but the rules are that there are no rules now. I mean, it's a deeply disturbing, horrendous decision, actually. It disenfranchises tens of millions of voters who will no longer, this basically says you got a Russian hacker out there who can draw districts, you know, that gerrymander them to the nth degree and guarantee that it produces a particular partisan result. That's fine with us, says the Supreme Court. I mean, this is a terrible decision for our country. I am convinced that within a decade or two, this will be looked back upon like the Dred Scott decision and the Bowers v. Hardwick decision as a black eye on the Supreme Court that will be ultimately overturned because it is a disastrous decision.
That opinion is certainly one that I saw in my inbox from several sources as this ruling came down. But to press you a little bit on it, Rob, what should they have done? Should they have set a two-prong standard or a three-prong standard?
I thought that Allison Riggs of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice made a very compelling argument that there were very cognizable prongs, if you want. There were tests that could be applied to determine whether or not we actually had partisan gerrymandering and that there were ways to address it and to ameliorate any kind of problem that came with it. So I don't think it was complicated at all. I thought her test that she articulated to the court made plenty of sense. The court could have adopted it. Clearly, four justices thought that we should have. Justice Kagan wrote a passionate dissent about how this was really a threat to American democracy, this decision, and I think she's right.
Well, of course, there were dissenting opinions on this. And again, I think we'll be studying this for the next several weeks and months and possibly years. One thing that the court did make clear was that it's not their jurisdiction to get involved in these political decisions and really threw that decision to Congress. So where that goes next and, again, whether the conversation has changed, many people, myself included, are not that optimistic that, I mean, Congress can't seem to get anything done.
There's
I don't know why they would. I don't know why they would tackle this, but it does kind of throw it over to Congress. So, you know, if we're concerned about it, then at least we know who to take it up with now.
Also from the High Court Thursday came a setback for the Trump administration as justices, with Roberts again as the deciding swing vote, rejected a proposal to add a question about citizenship to the census. Roberts called the motivation behind the question contrived. However, he effectively left the door open in terms of the White House providing a better or different justification for the citizenship question. Becky, would the people of North Carolina be better off with or without a citizenship question on the census next year?
You know, I may be missing something in this discussion, Jeff, but it seems to me that there's a real value of knowing who is here in North Carolina, who lives in particular households, how many children there are, you know, with obligations to provide social services, with obligations for education. It seems to me that the more information that we have, then the better we can provide. You know, we're just going through the state budget process. To have those numbers of people who may qualify, who may need different things, the pressures on the schools, it seems to me that that's valuable information to have. But what we see so often now is everything becomes a political question. And, you know, through the lens of, okay, is this going to help my team win or can it hurt the other guys? But looking at it, I don't know why. I just sort of err on the side of the more information that we have to use in a positive way is better. But I know that there's disagreement on that.
Well, I mean, the other side to that, there are two points to be made. Number one is that this will provide us with less information because we know that by asking the citizenship question, we will discourage participation. It's much like the proposals to force ICE local governments, local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE because it discourages participation from people who fear that their immigration status will be exposed and that they'll be deported. So we know for a fact that that will happen. It will discourage participation with the census. And we know that because of the Hoffeller files, because we know that this was decided, the Trump administration came up with this question, not because they had some genuine notion to really want to know information about immigrants. They wanted to discourage Latinx participation in elections to help Republicans. That was what was admitted in the files that Tom Hoffeller had on his computer. So I think basically, even John Roberts couldn't believe the excuses that Ross, Wilbur Ross, who's the head of the census, came up to, or Commerce, that came up to explain this reason for having this question. He said, you better come up with a better explanation than this, and it remains to be seen whether the Trump administration can do that.
And maybe we just need to come up with a better marketing plan as we move forward this, to explain to people why more information can be more helpful rather than instilling fear or, you know, other concerns.
Meanwhile, the House and Senate, here back to the General Assembly now, unveiled their budget compromise this week. Among the appropriations are raises for state employees and teachers, moving the entire Department of Health and Human Services to Granville County, corporate tax cuts or reductions, and no Medicaid expansion. Rob, there are a lot of line items for local projects. One may, in fact, call that pork within the spending plan.
Nothing new.
We saw multiple Democrats in each chamber vote to support this budget. How disappointing was that to you?
I think it's very disappointing when people sell out for pork, because that's basically what was going on, or because they were promised something, or there was a, you know, some sort of specific line item. Although I understand that they're, you know, can be irresistible when politics and politicians are in the business of getting reelected, they're in the business of trying to deliver for their communities. I mean, it's sort of shocking to me that many people are very candid about the fact that they'll vote for the budget, but they won't vote to override the governor, which is sort of like, I don't know how you have your cake and eat it, too. I guess it does allow this fig leaf to the Republicans that it's a bipartisan budget. But, I mean, I thought it was a compromise between the House and the Senate, but it wasn't a compromise between the legislature and the governor. There was no real movement towards the governor on any important issues. There wasn't any real negotiation there. We ignored climate. We ignored health care. DEQ couldn't get any money to deal with the PFAS crisis. Child care waiting lists were ignored. Taxes for corporations were expanded further. All those things were just a slap in the face of the governor. And so, I mean, if we're going to have some real compromise, let's have it. This ain't it.
I'm not sure. First of all, on just assuming that someone...
I guess I should ask you another question, yeah, right? You weren't too disappointed that Democrats voted to support the budget. You weren't. I know you weren't, right?
Well, I think, here's the deal. I think there's a lot of really good things in this budget. And I think to make an assumption that someone would only vote for it if they were paid off in some way is an unfair assessment. Unless somebody has talked to some of these Democrats who have voted and they said, yes, I voted for this because I got X in the budget. You know, it's kind of hard for me to believe that someone wouldn't vote for the budget because of the teacher pay increases, the state employees' pay increases, the money for Medicaid recipients, the money for enrollment growth, the money for public schools. I mean, there's a lot of really good things in this budget. I wish that we had more real honest debate and real honest votes and more legislators voting the way that their constituents want them to vote, rather than this, again, this partisan divide that we have, that somehow, you know, you're on one team or the other, and if you don't play with that team, then you're going to be ostracized and threatened and, you know, all kinds of things like that. There's a lot of good things in this budget. I have to believe that, you know, people looked at this and said, this is a good budget for my district.
But it's clear that political pressure plays an enormous role. There are plenty of Republicans who voted for the budget who didn't really want to vote for the budget, but they know they couldn't get away with it. They'd lose their committee chairpersonship, or they'd lose, I mean, let's not kid anybody about how this sausage gets ground. There is a lot of political pressure to do this, to vote one way or the other. That process is going to continue. I'm not convinced at all that there'll be an override of a gubernatorial veto.
So full disclosure, we're recording this on a Thursday, and as of this moment on Thursday, the governor's veto, I would describe it as imminent, but it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
I don't know if that's going to happen by the time that our conversation airs on the radio on Friday afternoon. Once that happens, then what? Who's move? What's next in the short term?
Well, I think the obvious first step would be when the governor vetoes it, and he said he's going to, and I don't know why he would wait to do it. I mean, he has said since January, if the budget doesn't have Medicaid expansion in it, I'm going to veto it. So I'm thinking he's waiting on the steps of the mansion. When it comes over, he's going to say, is Medicaid expansion in there? The answer is no. You know, he should go ahead and stamp it and get on with things. The next obvious step is that it comes back to the General Assembly for an override consideration. Now, with these Democrats who have voted for the budget, the question arises, would they vote for an override of the governor's veto? And would there be enough?
You would need that additional Democrats in the House in order to override.
Would there be enough? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure anybody does. One thing I'm pretty sure of is assuming that there are some conversations and some text messages and some telephone calls and probably some calls to come up to the governor's mansion to have a talk about this. I don't know. That is a possibility. I would venture to say probably an unlikely. Mm-hmm. It's a heavy lift to get those votes for an override, but that would be the next step in this.
Republicans would need seven. If Republicans hold its own caucus, which we expect on the House side, there are 65 of them. You need 3/5 to override. If the chamber is full, you need 7 Democrats. That, to me, is a stretch.
I agree.
Alluded to before, you think that they will be able to maintain this veto.
Well, yeah, and what ought to happen here, I think Becky's right, the governor will probably act pretty quickly. The legislature says they're going home next week, or they're going to take the week off, basically, and not be in session next week. At least that's what I've heard.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So what ought to happen during that time, and before we get back to serious business, is that Governor Cooper, Speaker Moore, President Pro Tem Berger, Minority Leaders Blue and Jackson, the five of them, I would argue, should get together in a room and hash this darn thing out. There ought to be some real compromise in which there's movement in both directions. We recognize that neither side is going, if we're going to have a new budget this year, that neither side can get everything that they want. That ought to be, we should have actually been doing that for weeks, if not months, but I would hope there would be another effort to force these people to actually sit down together, and then they can all come and have a press conference with the lights shining on them, and you can be standing there, Jeff, taking notes and recording what they have to say, and we can get a deal. And I'm certain that that's what the people of North Carolina want. They would like some sort of middle ground government. That's why they got rid of the supermajorities last fall. That's why they've elected Governor Cooper. They want compromise between Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans haven't offered any yet.
Let's try it right now. A little one-to-one exercise. You have no idea this is coming. I was not planning to do this. This was not intended to come out of the pocket. Medicaid's the big thing. You want Medicaid. You don't want any strings attached to it. You want clean Medicaid expansion. You, Becky, don't want any Medicaid expansion in this state. Where's the middle ground between you two on this?
Well, I mean, there have been Republican efforts. There have been Republican lawmakers who have introduced bills that represent somewhat of a middle ground.
Are you good with a work requirement?
I'm not good with it, but I think it's. I can imagine some sort of a. I'm an advocate. I'm a journalist. I'm not a politician. I'm not in the. I don't have to cut that deal and sign
pragmatism
that bill.
Pragmatism game, sure.
But I mean, I can imagine a scenario where they. I mean, the idea that. Oh, we'll talk about this in a special session in a few weeks, maybe. I mean, that's no compromise. That's just, an empty promise. We've seen what special sessions have produced around here, so I can understand why Cooper would say, the heck with that.
What concessions would you be willing to make on Medicaid, Rob? Is there?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm not in the business of negotiating I mean, it seems to me that there is a way to expand Medicaid without doing the whole nine yards. I mean, it obviously can be. And the bottom line is that if we can get hundreds of thousands of people access to health insurance who don't have it now, we will literally save thousands of lives and bring billions of dollars into our state. So there was just a study released this week that showed we can create thousands of jobs in our state, bring billions of dollars into the state. It was a very powerful report from researchers at George Washington University. I can't believe we're just going to turn our backs on that for yet another year.
Well, and, the other side of this is we have a Medicaid program in North Carolina that is fragile at best. We've had reports from Beth Woods, the state auditor, of example after example of waste and fraud and money that is just bleeding out of the program. Medicaid was designed and services low-income individuals, mm-hmm. aged, disabled, mm-hmm. Poor pregnant women and poor children. About 2 million people of North Carolina's 10 million people are currently on Medicaid. Half the babies born in North Carolina mm-hmm. are born under Medicaid. So we have this tremendous population who is dependent on Medicaid for their health care services. And this is the program, and these are the folks that it was designed for. So until we start talking about adding another 500,000, 600,000 additional people onto a program that is struggling to provide the needed services for those who currently qualify for Medicaid, I think we need to step back from that and not overburden that. The other thing is, on this population of the Medicaid expansion, about 80% of those people are working age, childless, able-bodied adults. And a lot of these people on this population have private health insurance. Now, what we've seen in other states is that they drop that health insurance when Medicaid is available to them. So there's just some problems with it that I think it's foolish to add this population, that the structure of Medicaid may very well not be able to provide them the services that they're seeking.
But of course, the legislature has just cut funding for Medicaid. Even in the budget that they're proposing now, they've cut funding for. That's going to draw down even fewer state dollars for this. You know, they're talking about a transition to managed care and all that kind of stuff. And 37 states have done this, and it's just it's not accurate, actually, to say that the current program is not succeeding. It does an amazing job of serving the people that it serves, and it provides health insurance, as you say, to a huge proportion of our population. Mm-hmm. Does a great job of it for such a massive program with actually lower rises in costs and expenditures than private health insurance.
And some other areas of healthcare.
And we're going through this transition period of how it's managed and how people get their care. And when you have a program of this size, you need to make sure that it is sustainable enough to provide those. But the real question with this whole debate, really, and I just have to say this real quick, I think we're asking the wrong question with mm-hmm. this. What we ought to be asking is, if health insurance is too expensive for 600,000-700,000 individuals to be able to afford because the health care costs are so expensive in order to provide that insurance, shouldn't we be looking at how do we reduce the cost of health care so that it's more manageable? And there's a lot of different ways that you can do that, whether it's with certificate of need repeal, whether it's employing more telemedicine that is a less expensive way to do it, whether it is expanding scope of practice so that nurse practitioners and dental therapists and other sort of mid-level providers can fill in some of those areas. You know, there's a whole myriad of things that can be done to lower the cost of health care that then will make health insurance more affordable for everyone.
Those are all fine ideas to look at, but they're not going to save the 1,500 people who are going to die prematurely in 2019 and 2020 because they don't have health coverage. And that's not going to get us to a point where those people's lives are saved. And that's what the bottom line is, what it comes down to. People are going to die unnecessarily because we don't expand this program.
We will have plenty more time to talk about Medicaid in the weeks and perhaps months to come. I want you to know. Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch, and Becky Gray is the senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Who would you like to hear on the WNC Politics podcast in the coming weeks? Let me know. Shoot me an email or find me on Twitter at @J_TIBS. You can, of course, stay up to date with some of the reporting of my colleagues, Rusty Jacobs, Jason DeBruin, Cole Del Charco, a number of folks. That's at our website, wunc.org. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. Enjoy your weekend. Talk to you again soon. So come back.